The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for September 16th, 2017. There are a lot of news stories this week, including a comprehensive piece of legislation in Illinois that is the most pro-cyclist we've seen. Chris Froome did indeed win the Vuelta, and Alberto Contador did indeed retire. Peter Sagan won his 100th race, and there is so much more. But our show this evening actually addresses none of those things. In fact, we're going to begin in Boston and end up right back here in Northeast Ohio. Late last month, Brian and I received a message on Facebook from Matthew Crompton. He's an Ohioan now living in Australia. He just completed a 5,000-kilometer ride across Central Asia, and since he's home visiting his folks and having his trusty steed serviced, I thought I'd snag him and have a chat about living, working, and riding down under. Matt will be with me in the second half of our show. With the New England Builders Ball only a week away, I thought we could take a few minutes to catch up with the show's director, Eric Weiss, so that he could slow down for a second and take a breath. Then we stay right there in Massachusetts to talk with one of the exhibitors who will be at the Builders Ball this year. Dave Dean is the inventor and maker of SineWave products. When I first met Dave at NABS a few years ago, SineWave was just making its debut. And today, the company offers its original products, USB chargers that run from the generator power aboard your bike, to other add-ons, including a brand new headlamp. We'll talk with Dave about his products and how he came to invent them and what's new since the last time I saw him. Then it's off to San Diego to talk with Len G., fundraising specialist with the EOD Warrior Foundation. And if you don't know what EOD stands for, as I didn't until I delved into the information about it, it's Explosive Ordnance Disposal. Just saying those words gave me chills, but there is an upside to this story, including a series of cycling events with the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Warrior Foundation to help those who tackle this dangerous and often deadly work. So let's get over to Boston and get this episode of the show rolling. Hi, Eric. Hard to believe we're T-minus 1 week from the 2017 New England Builders Ball. How are you?
Oh, Diane, I'm so excited. The show is coming together so well. I was feeling some anxiety earlier in the year. This is the first time we put the show in Boston.
Right.
And it's sort of the regional capital for New England. And so moving the show there is a big step for this show. And everybody seems pretty excited about this. And
I'm excited.
I'm kind of over the moon about putting this show in an area where there's a much bigger population. It'll be a lot easier for larger numbers of people to come out to the show. And I think it's going to be great for the exhibitors, great for the attendees, great for the show's sponsors. I'm feeling pretty jazzed.
So did you talk to the weather gods and say, don't mess with the weather?
Right. Yeah, so this being the Boston area, of course I went to MIT and said, what can you do? And they said, oh, yeah, we've got some equipment.
Right.
And apparently they're just going to flip a switch and a giant Lucite dome will come down over the city and it'll... Yeah.
That's great. That's great. So, you know what? I saw something, I think it was on Instagram, about a cyclist cup. What is that? That old collapsible cup?
You've been walking through my Instagram page. That's
great.
Of course. So this is a really fun piece of cycling history, the cyclist cup. So is this a company that had been based in Connecticut, which is now, it still exists. It's in Georgia, but the company was founded in something like the year 1800 in Connecticut, called Sperry is the name of the company. And at the time, excuse me, not Sperry, Scoville, as in chili peppers, Scoville.
Okay.
Regiment. And so mostly throughout history, they've made buttons. Like if you were in the Revolutionary War on either side, you sewed up your jacket with their buttons. And one of the items that they made in the late 1800s was this thing called the cyclist cup, which is a collapsible cup, brass, nickel-plated, with a lid. And since it's collapsible, it's only maybe an inch thick. But then you can take the lid off and pull out the cup. And so if you're riding around and you come across a fountain or a spring or something, you just fill up your cup and enjoy. And I've got a couple of those at home. My daughter likes drinking out of them. They're kind of fun.
Where did you find them?
Oh, I see them at auctions.
Ah.
I go to the Copaic bike auction every year. And these things, you can find them on eBay. If you go on eBay and just type in cyclist cup, they tend to run $25 to $40, depending on condition.
Well, it's very cool looking. It's very cool.
It's a lot of fun. And it's a really interesting piece of cycling history.
So back to the Builder's Ball, and this is one of those questions. Are you expecting any surprises, which, of course, would kill the whole surprise, but whatever?
Well, yeah, if I had any real surprises, I would probably find a way to hint at them.
Okay.
As a way to entreat people to show up and say, what's going on here? I will say this. Some really cool things are happening. One is 44 Bikes is using the Builder's Ball to launch its titanium line, which is really cool. Chris Henry from 44 Bikes has been dabbling for a while, and he finally feels like he's got his chops down with welding titanium, and he's going to be showing only Thai bikes at the show. And we have the 2017 Rat Rod Build-Off champion showing his bike at the show. And this thing is completely radical. I really think encourage your listeners to go to the Builder's Ball Instagram or Facebook and check out this bike. It's just a phenomenal piece of art. And one builder who's not so well known yet, who I'm really excited about what he's putting together, is Porter Cycles from Brooklyn. And he's been on his Instagram, been showing off some nickel-plated pieces, forks and stems, really wonderfully sexy pieces. And he's got a great eye for design and he's a really great fabricator. So I'm excited to see his booth as well.
It's interesting you use the word sexy when it comes to bicycles, because I find bicycles sexy in their own right, too. Having been involved with them for so many, many years. One of the things you do say on the website is that formal wear is not required. So it's okay to wear a tux or a gown, right?
Right. It's not required. If you want to show up wearing a tux or a gown, that is perfectly fine.
But cycling shoes are okay.
Yep. You can wear your tap shoes in the venue. That's fine.
Yeah. How about bike parking?
The building itself has about 300 covered bike parking spaces where you can lock up, which is really exciting. It's the bike friendliest building in the city of Boston, as far as I can see. 300 interior bike parking spaces, plus at least one, I'm thinking perhaps as many as three Dero fix-it stations inside. Even the street level up to the entrance level, the stairs have wheel runnels in them. So you can just wheel your bike up a ramp while you're walking up the stairs. They thought of everything.
You're the first person I ever heard use the word runnels. And then I interviewed a woman who has a bed and breakfast up in Michigan, and she built her, when they remodeled this beautiful old house, they put this ramp down, and I told her, oh, those are called runnels. I was so excited that I could tell her.
Maybe I made that word up, and now you're just spreading misinformation.
Well, if it is, and it's our word, we can do whatever we want with it. All right, let's give our listeners the pertinent information about where, when, and then we'll sign off and let you get back to planning.
Okay, terrific. Thank you, Diane. So it's the New England Builders Ball, 7th edition. The location is the Boston Design Center, which is in Boston's Seaport District, Saturday, September 23rd. Opening 2 p.m., closing 10 p.m. This year's beloved sponsors are Copenhagen Wheel, Shimano, and Harpoon Brewery. If you're an adult, it's about the cost of going to a movie, free for under 12. And so bring your family.
Well, I am so looking forward to not only seeing you, but seeing all the builders and talking to people who might listen to the show. So I'm excited. I'll see you in 1 week.
Looking forward to seeing you, Diane.
All right. You take care and chill out. Everything's going to be good.
Terrific.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Eric Weiss joined me from his office to give us a last-minute look at the New England Builders Ball. The show is an expo of hand-built bikes, accessories, garments, and art, and Brian and I are very much looking forward to being there. After break, we'll be back to speak with Dave Dean from Sinewave. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and from Boston, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump over to Cambridge, where we're going to catch up with Dave Dean from Sinewave. Hi, Dave. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this week.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. We met at NABS a few years ago. I stopped by your booth to check out your company, and now I'm finally going to be able to catch up with you and see you again next weekend at the Builders Ball. Are you excited?
I am excited. I'm excited that it's moved to Boston. It was a very good show in Providence for a couple of years, and then in Thompson last year. And I'm really excited to see it moving up into Boston.
Well, we're really excited to come out and see it, too. We haven't been to Boston. Well, I haven't been there in quite some time. My husband was there not too long ago. So let's talk about Sinewave, your company. How did you come up with this idea of these USB chargers that you could take with you on the bike?
Sure. So I got into bicycle touring about 10 years ago and did a couple, short-ish trips, maybe a week or two. And then in 2011, rode solo across the country and brought a smartphone with me, which was my, maps and camera and email. I kept a blog at home that I had to use email for, and then had to call my wife every night at 8 o'clock to let her know that I had made it through the day. And, having that and using it or relying on it sort of saw how difficult it was to keep it charged, stopping at gas stations to plug in or a campground bathroom, things like that. And it's just sort of a hassle. And then I met someone on that trip at a Dynamo Hub. I had never even knew they existed. And, I said, wow, that's amazing, the ability to, produce your own electricity on these trips. And so I finally ended the trip and I got home and learned that the Dynamo powered chargers do exist, but felt that there was room for a lot of improvement with what existed. And so the following year, started Sinewave Cycles and just sort of designed our version of the charger and been selling it since 2013.
So what is your background? Are you an engineer?
I'm an electrical engineer.
Of course you are. I should have guessed that right from the get-go. So tell us a little bit about the product. So you have two basic chargers. One's called the Revolution and the other one is the...
The reactor.
Right? Okay.
So the Revolution was that first one, and it's, you know, we aimed for simplicity with the design because being large and bulky or being kind of overly complicated was, I thought, a problem with some of the other chargers that exist. So it's about the size of a matchbox and, you know, a long wire to plug in the dynamo. The other end is just a USB connector. Plug in your phone or a battery or whatever you're going to charge, and you leave that mounted to the bike frame anywhere you want, or put it, it's small, so you can leave it in a handlebar bag, something like that, and just, you know, as long as you're riding, it'll charge your phone. And then the reactor, we took those electronics, and it's funny that you mentioned that we met at NABS, because when we did the reactor, the sort of the explicit goal was to say, I want to take the Revolution charger and make it prettier, you know, something that would look at home on a bike that's at that show. And so we designed it in a bunch of different colors, and it's a stem cap charger. So it sort of looks integrated in with the bike, but then otherwise has the same electrical performance as the Revolution. And so, again, you just plug in your phone, go for a ride, and you keep the charge while you're on the road.
I'm speaking with Dave Dean. He is the creator of SineWave, the USB chargers that you can charge your phone or your other mobile device. You can probably charge an iPad, anything. So how easy is it? How fast does it charge? What kind of results do you get? Is it ongoing? As long as you're pedaling, it will keep charging?
Yeah. It you know, exactly how much power you're putting into the phone depends on you know, the dynamo hub you're using, how fast you're riding, how much power the phone itself wants to take. But you usually find that the amount of power you're putting into your phone is more than the phone is using. So you can use it during the course of the day. You can have it navigating for you or playing music, and it will keep it charged and not, you know, not run out of energy, not run out of power while you're riding.
So besides the two USB chargers, the one that goes on your stem or the little matchbox one, the original Revolution, I see some other products on your website now. Are you making your own dynamo hub, or are you offering a specific one that works better or well with your products?
No, we do sell through our website hubs from both Shutter Precision and Schmidt. They both have their own pros and cons, and they both work great with our chargers, as do other you know, dynamo hubs that are out there from Shimano or other companies. And then we do have a few users using you know, the old-fashioned bottle generators also that do work with our chargers as well.
So are you going to be showing anything new or different at the Builders Ball next week? Just asking.
We do. We have, in addition to the chargers, we have a dynamo-powered headlight now as well, the SineWave Cycles Beacon, which we first showed at NABS earlier this year in Salt Lake City, and has a USB charge integrated into it along with the headlight and a few other neat features that sort of make it stand out a bit from the crowd of dynamo headlights, and that will be at the show in Boston as well.
Oh, that's great. I'll be anxious to see it. So who typically is purchasing your product? Do you know who your core customer is? Is it a commuter or a tourist? Or
I think it's mostly tours, randonneurs, other long-distance riders. I usually say that anyone who is out for a ride that lasts longer than the battery on your phone would be a potential customer. So that could include just people who go on long day rides with Strava, you know, keeping track of them, and that would, you know, could burn through a cell phone battery in just a few hours, and you can keep that charge that way, all the way up to people who are just on the road for years and you know, try to be off the grid as much as possible, and are just on a long bike tour and don't want to stop to worry about plugging it into the wall.
Why don't you give our listeners the website and let them go sort of look through it, and then we'll ask them if they are in the area and they are interested. You'll be able to see the SineWave products at the Builders Ball. Do you know your booth number, Dave?
Offhand, I do not.
Okay.
but we will be there. The website is SineWaveCycles.com.
Okay.
SineWave.
And we will put that up on our Facebook page, and I'll look forward to seeing you next weekend and seeing the headlight. That'll be cool.
Yeah, it sounds great.
All right. Well, thank you for talking with me today, and have a good afternoon.
I thank you, too.
All righty. Bye-bye. Dave Dean joined me from the offices at SineWave in Cambridge, Mass. For more information on the products and company, you can take a look at their website, SineWaveCycles.com, or just check out the products in person if you are in Boston for the New England Builders Ball next weekend. After a short break, we're going to talk with Len G from the EOD Warrior Foundation. Remember, you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I got this really unusual press release. I mean, I get a lot of them, but when I read the organization that you are part of and looked into it, I'm like, okay, that's terrifying. Give us a bit of background on the EOD and the EOD Warrior Foundation. What does EOD stand for? And how scary is it?
Okay, first off, let's start with what EOD stands for. It stands for Explosive Ordnance Disposal. For a lot of people that aren't familiar with it, I say if you've ever seen the movie The Hurt Locker, those are the folks we're talking about. Basically, the bomb squad for the military.
That's terrifying.
It can be. The EOD Warrior Foundation, in its present iteration, started about 5 years ago. It was born out of two prior organizations, the Wounded EOD Warrior Foundation and the EOD Memorial Fund. And those were two separate entities. And then in around, I believe it was about 5 years ago, those merged and the present EOD Warrior Foundation was born. What we do is we take care of EOD techs and their families above and beyond what the federal government provides in terms of assistance to wounded EOD techs. We provide financial assistance, grants and scholarships, therapeutic retreats, and we also maintain the EOD Memorial, which is located at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida.
So are these warriors, are these service people from all branches of the military?
They are. EOD is across the services. It's both men and women. They all go through the same school, which is down at Eglin Air Force Base. It's called NAV School EOD. And all of the branches send their prospective techs to this school.
So do you have any sense of how many techs are in the field today and how many are now retired for one reason or another?
Currently, we have a little over 7,000 techs serving on active duty, and that's across all the services. In terms of retired, I don't have a statistic on that, but in one form or another, there has been an EOD occupation, let's say, since around World War II time. So there's been quite a lot of techs that have served over the years.
So here's a question that didn't occur to me until I started thinking about this, and that is, how much explosive ordnance is there, and where is it?
Well, when we talk about explosive ordnance, it's a wide range of things. It could be unexploded ordnance that has been dropped from an aircraft. It could be, which when we talk about it today, it mainly focuses in on IEDs, and that is improvised explosive devices. And those are the really dangerous and most lethal things that are out there on the battlefield that we see today. A lot of terrorist organizations employ these, and basically what they are is they take a munition, the explosive component to that munition, and they modify it to make what you would consider to be a homemade bomb, and they detonate those in various ways. And so the techs that are serving today encounter these on a regular basis and have to either render them safe, destroy them in place, or take care of them in one way or another.
Wow. So let's talk about the ride that's going to go on and get away a little bit from the war part. These are warriors who are now home, who may or may not be injured, who may or may not have families that need help. Tell us about Navy EOD Commander Kevin. Is it Childre?
Kevin Childre.
Childre.
Kevin, wow, where to begin with Kev? Kevin was probably the best friend I've ever had. Kevin and I have been riding bikes together for, man, well over 15 years. And Kevin was the longest serving EOD tech in the Navy. He was someone that a lot of people say they lead by example. Kevin truly did lead by example. I like to say that Kev led out of fear. It wasn't fear of reprisal. It was fear of letting him down. Kev was the one that started the Undefeated Ride close to 9 years ago. And he recognized that there was a need to supply funding to the, at that time, the Wounded EOD Warrior Foundation. And so he got a group of us together that were his friends and colleagues and said, hey, I want to put on this ride. And so he kind of delegated responsibilities to all of us. And through the years, it has morphed into a franchised ride. It's in several locations throughout the country. But unfortunately, Kev was killed on a ride that we were on together. Another ride that we do, we happen to ride on a Navy, that's called Paladar Navy Cycling here in San Diego. It was a group that Kevin had put together to promote a positive public image of Navy special warfare. And one of the events we do was called the Train of Pain. And what that was basically we would pick locations in the United States. And for a week, we would do 100-mile-a-day rides out of there. And it would just be trying to go out there and beat up on the other guys as much as you can. And the 2015 edition had started in San Francisco. And we were heading down. We were just below Vandenberg Air Force Base. And that's where tragedy struck. Kev and another cyclist collided, and Kev sustained massive head injuries and passed away as a result of those.
Oh, my goodness. So this wasn't an automobile crash?
No. Kev, it was a very slow-speed crash. We were decelerating and there was confusion on the route, and Kev was looking over his right shoulder to tell the couple of guys behind us, hey, we're going to veer right. And at that point, someone, one of the other cyclists, was not looking either, and they collided, and Kev hit the deck below where the helmet protects and sustained massive injuries there. We tried to do all we could for Kev out there on the road. The person he collided with happened to be an anesthesiologist, and we were doing everything that we humanly could do to take care of him. Unfortunately, there was just nothing that we could do that would save his life.
Wow, I'm so sorry to hear that. That is incredibly sad. You are continuing his legacy, though, with these rides. Tell us about the rides that are coming up. And I want to know about the Florida ride. Is that still going to happen?
Yeah, actually it is. I was speaking with the ride director yesterday, and the Florida ride takes place in the Fort Walton Beach area, which is kind of up there in the panhandle. And it avoided, let's say, significant damage like the rest of the state got. So she was going to go out and ride the course in a vehicle to make sure it was all good. But in talking with her, the plans are to continue the ride there in Fort Walton Beach, just like normal, with no alterations. We do have other rides. Texas, it was affected. That ride has now been converted into a virtual ride. We have several virtual rides that take place literally all over the world. Some of these occur at ships at sea. Some are at bases in other countries, things like that. But the main rides here in the United States are California, Florida, Texas, Virginia, and now in Colorado.
So how can people find out more about the ride? And so anybody can participate, obviously. It's not just service people.
Anyone can participate. The ride website is eodride.org. You can go there and all of the rides are listed. You can sign up for the rides there. You can donate to the rides there. All the information about the ride is contained there. You can see pictures of past rides. There's pictures of Kevin, the rest of the folks that kind of put it on. So all the information about the ride is contained there.
Well, I really appreciate you talking with me about it. It's a scary thing, this EOD stuff. And unfortunately, I'm sorry to hear about your friend Kevin. He did a great thing putting these rides together. So it's eodride.org. We've been speaking with Len G. He's out in San Diego. I assume you're going to do the California ride, or are you going to go somewhere else?
I am.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to do the California ride.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, and good luck with the event this year, or events, plural. And we'll post it on our Facebook page.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great ride this year, and thanks for talking with me today.
Great. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Len G is in San Diego getting ready to launch the Undefeated Warrior Ride Series. For more information, you can log on to eodwarriorfoundation.org. So in the second half of the show, I'm going to introduce you to Matthew Crompton. The Northeast Ohio native is home for a visit with family, but he lives in Australia. His story and his recent 5,000-kilometer ride through Central Asia is fascinating. We'll be right back after a break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. To be called Matt or Matthew?
Matthew, generally.
Matthew it is. All right, here we go. Hi, Matthew. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me here in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
How is it being back in the States?
It's really pretty great. You know, this is the longest period I've spent in the States since I sort of left for good back in 2008. And it's really nice getting to have a more relaxed visit with family and friends and see the places that I've missed.
So you did grow up here in Northeast Ohio?
Yeah, I grew up just outside of Chardon in Munson Township and lived in the same house my entire life until I left for university, where my parents still live.
So where did you go to school?
I went to Munson Elementary School and then Chardon Middle and Chardon High School. And then when I finished sort of secondary schooling, I ended up going to Cleveland State and graduated from there in, I think, 2002.
Wow. That was a while ago.
It was a while ago.
It's like time flies when you're having this much fun, huh? So, you know, it's interesting to me how stories come to me. They come in the form of press releases or somebody tells me something. Yours was an interesting way you got to us. You found us because you were needing service on your bike.
Correct.
And you contacted us through our Facebook page, and your bike, it's a giant bike, is sitting in our shop. Well, actually, it's probably on the stand right now, and you're here sitting with me. How is it driving on the other side of the road right now?
To be honest, the driving thing, everyone thinks that it's going to throw you for a loop. It really doesn't. The only time that you really have problems with it is late at night when there's no traffic to follow and you go, oh, do I turn onto the left or the right side of the road? Otherwise, it's really pretty automatic and there's always something to follow.
Yeah. Well, plus you probably drove before you went to Australia. Do you own a car in Australia?
No, thank God.
All right. So tell us how you ended up in the Southern Hemisphere so far from home.
It's a long story, but basically I had moved to Seoul in South Korea and was teaching English there for 2 years from 2009 to 2011. And I really enjoyed the sort of ESL, teaching English as a second language thing, but I was a little bit tired of being a primary school teacher because it's sort of, you know, you put on the clown suit and do slapstick, and I wanted to do something a little bit more involved after getting 2 years of experience. And so I was looking at programs where I could do a master's in education or applied linguistics, and was looking at programs outside the United States. And basically, there was one at the University of New South Wales that was well regarded. And so I said, oh, I'll see what happens here. And I applied and got accepted like 2 weeks later. And so without really a whole lot of effort or planning, I sort of ended up there, did my degree there, and ended up getting a job with the university and navigating the horrible bureaucracy to become a permanent resident and then a citizen. And now I'm there.
So you are a dual citizen?
I am now, yes, as of February of this year.
Oh, congratulations, I think, yes?
Thank you, yeah.
So, because I know you said you consider yourself an Aussie. So tell us a little bit about the country. I think everybody has this kind of secret desire to go to Australia. At least I do. My daughter would be like over the moon to be able to go. What is it about Australia that's so compelling to you?
Well, I mean, the reason that I ended up settling there is not necessarily that I went there and fell in love with, you know, the bush or the landscape, even though that's really wonderful. The thing that really kept me there was that they have a great healthcare system, and my rights and privileges as a worker were really good. So that was the reason that I stayed. I said, you know, my quality of life is really good there. And it took me a while, actually, to get used to the Australian bush, because it's very different. You know, it's all sort of gum trees. It's often dry and very different to what I grew up with here in Northeast Ohio. But I've developed a real affection for it. I think a lot of people don't really have a clear idea of what Australia is like. For one thing, even though it's, you know, an entire continent with a tiny population, it is also incredibly heavily urbanized in that much of the population, a huge percentage of the population, lives in a handful of urban centers. So it's more like an archipelago of cities than it is sort of like America, where you have big population centers spread all over the map. But the thing that I really like about it now that I've been there is because of that, because the population centers are so isolated and there's so much space. You know, I live in central Sydney, and it is a dense built-up city. But if you go an hour out of the city in any direction, especially up or down the coast, you can be in a place that's quite untouched and quite wild. And that's just really neat. It is incredibly wonderful to me just how untouched so much of the country feels, even very close to population centers.
Wow. I mean, so do you go to the Sydney Opera House? Have you been there?
I've seen a couple of things there. I've never seen the opera there, but I've seen a couple of performances. But mostly it's one of those buildings that's actually nicer on the outside than the inside. The inside is lovely. But it's on my running route that I do around the harbor. So it's something that I see pretty frequently.
And so wait, you run as well as ride?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like life isn't that much different, right?
No, it's all the same, man.
Yeah. How about kangaroos? Do you get to really see kangaroos?
You do get to see kangaroos. Oh. And it's silly because they're basically just – they occupy the same sort of ecological niche as deer. You know, they're just weird deer. But every time I see them, I'm still just amazed at how cool they are. And every now and again, you'll get to see some of the other sort of funny Australian wildlife. We have the kookaburra, which is a species of kingfisher with a giant head with the craziest laughing call. It's the most quintessentially Australian sound. Every now and again, you'll see an echidna, you know. So it's a monotreme, like a platypus, and it's a really primitive mammal. And they're just weird, spiny-looking creatures. And every time I see the weird Australian creatures after 5 years, I'm still excited every time.
Oh, sure. How about koala?
There are no koalas around Sydney, so I've never seen them in the wild, unfortunately.
Yeah, that is unfortunate. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Matthew Crompton. He is visiting the States. He lives in Australia. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the riding you've done. You just completed a 5,000-kilometer ride across what you called Central Asia. Tell me where that is exactly on the map and what it was like.
I mean, it's not exactly well-defined. To some extent, it's easiest to understand it as being the countries that end with Stan. So I think people hear Stan and they think Afghanistan and Pakistan, and those are not necessarily the most representative countries of the region in a lot of ways. There's Kazakhstan, which is enormous, which is geographically the ninth largest country in the world, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan. So it's all of these countries that were quite interesting to me because I traveled a lot in Asia, and Asia on a whole is often quite touristy. But it seems like very few people get to Central Asia and often don't really have a great deal of idea of what it's really like there. And I know that before I went there, I really didn't either. I was surprised by what I found going there.
And what did you find?
I mean, even really basic stuff that I just had no idea. So, for example, you have all of these countries that end with Stan, and you think that they're quite similar, therefore. But the Kazakh people and the Kyrgyz people both look East Asian, for example. And then you cross the border into Tajikistan, and people look Indo-European again. And there's this big jump. And linguistically, the Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz speak languages that are sort of mutually intelligible and I think are Turkic languages. But then the Tajiks will speak Tajik, which is just sort of a dialect almost of Farsi or Persian. So throughout Afghanistan, Iran, and Tajik, the language is actually to some extent mutually intelligible, though they use different scripts in Tajikistan. They use a Cyrillic script instead of an Arabic script.
So are you able to speak any of these languages, understand them, or was it all like sign language and I'm hungry?
You get good at miming to a certain extent. I'd spent some time in China and the Tibetan regions of China where, you know, I couldn't read Chinese script. So there was a lot more sort of miming there. The nice thing about being in Central Asia is because they were all former Soviet satellite republics, to a greater or lesser extent, Russian is still spoken as a lingua franca by everyone. The older generation who lived during the Soviet Union tend to speak it very well, but even the younger generation will speak some Russian. So when I got to Bishkek, which was early in my trip through Central Asia, I stopped for about a week and studied some Russian at a school there. And while my Russian decayed significantly throughout, you know, the next few months because I wasn't really having conversations with it, in terms of being able to make yourself understood and to understand basic things from other people, it really wasn't bad. You know, with quite basic Russian and the ability to read the Cyrillic alphabet, you feel a lot less lost than I certainly did in China.
How about the food? What did you find interesting about the culture of food and eating when you're on the road? Because, of course, we ride to eat, right? Or we eat to ride, something like that.
Yeah, you generally do. I don't think anyone goes to Central Asia for an experience of gourmandery.
Okay.
So, I mean, food, there's a lot of flatbread. There's often a lot of stale flatbread. There's a dish called plov, which is sort of pilaf. So it's sort of a bit of rice and vegetables in oil with some meat, which can range from very good to sort of reheated dog food. But just in general, it's not a foodie place. You can get some good food, but that's mostly in the major cities. And I had experiences where sometimes I would go into a village and I'd be out of food. I would have been out of civilization for a few days, would have cooked up all my food when camping and was really looking forward to a proper meal. And the village has one restaurant. And the restaurant is open. And the restaurants often have a menu, but the menu is notional. So it's best just to ask what they actually have, because usually they don't have much. But there's usually something. So you'd go into a restaurant and you sort of ask them what they have. And I would say, oh, you know, что еда можно? Like, what food is possible? And they'd look at me and they'd go, еда нет. There is no food. So it's the one restaurant in the town. They are open and sitting in the restaurant, and they have no food. And so then it's Snickers for dinner.
Oh, interesting.
So there are a lot of really amazing things about Central Asia, the landscape, the people, though I don't think anyone travels there for the food.
Okay, got it. I got it. Interesting. So you have been traveling alone? You traveled by yourself?
I have been traveling alone.
Did you pick up any hitchhikers along the way?
No, sadly. I the bike is large, but still only large enough for one.
Yeah, and that's what I want to talk about, a little bit about the bike. The bike is titanium. It is large. It is an Australian crafted bike, and it reminds me of a fat bike, but you used a term that I'm not quite as familiar with, 29 and a half?
So it's sometimes known as a 29-plus bike or just a plus bike. So essentially the rim is 29 inches wide and the tire is 3 inches wide. So the outside diameter of the tire is about 31 inches. So it's really a monster truck tire.
It's millimeters, right? Not 31 inches.
No, it's inches in this case.
Oh.
Yeah. They're still using inches as tire sizes.
Oh, interesting.
Australia has been metricized, but not completely. There's still conventions that are inches.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Sorry.
But so the diameter of the tire is enormous, and it's really useful on this quite rough terrain in that, one, it rolls over things quite easily. The sort of angle of attack over, a rock or a log in the trail is very good. And you can roll over things that are quite huge without really having to lose speed. The other benefit is because the tires are very high volume and because I run them tubeless, which I think is going to be the way everything is in 10 years, basically you can run them at incredibly low pressures. So if I'm in sandy terrain, for example, it allows me to have a bit of flotation. And if I'm in terrain that's rough, you have a bit of suspension it's undampened, granted, but it's quite helpful. I'd gone through a route in the Bartang Valley in the Pamirs, which is a remote region of eastern Tajikistan, and a lot of the time the road is the worst road you've ever seen. It's rocky, rutted, steep, loose, numerous river crossings. The river sometimes just covers the road and you have to wade up to hip depth. And typically people who do this route do it in about 7 or 8 days. And because I had equipment that was really well suited to it, I think I did it in 4. So most of the time I'm slower on the roads, but the plus bike is narrower than a fat bike tire and is really pretty good on the pavement too. You don't lose that much in the way of speed. But when you go off-road, the difference between that and a sort of traditional touring bike, traditional touring tire is really night and day.
Yeah, everything's going to wider tires, much to Brian's glee.
Mm.
He's been talking wider tires for 20 years, and now it's catching up with him. Go figure, right? So when you aren't riding, what are you doing down there?
So my day job down in Sydney is I work for the business arm of the University of New South Wales, and I write literacy tests.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's something that before I started doing it, you realize that someone has to write these things, but you don't ever think about it. And any time that you've ever taken a standardized test where you read a little text and then you read and answer the questions about it, I write the text and the questions. And I work with a really great group of smart, weird, funny people. And I get to do creative work, even if the application is quite strange. And so that's the day job. And I've been doing that for about 4 years before I took a year's unpaid leave to to go ride across Asia.
And is that how long it took you? Did you take a year?
No, I've only been off for about 5 months. And I've taken a break because I was burnt out.
Yeah. Riding through all those stands.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So what made you come home?
To be honest, I think the single thing that triggered it was that I had gone into Tajikistan, and this is about, almost 4 months in, and I'd ridden the Bartang Valley, which is a quite demanding route and something I'd really been looking forward to. And it wasn't well-traveled. I think I was one of three people that I sort of saw riding bicycles on the route. But then there's another route on the southern border of Tajikistan that everyone raves about, which is the Wakhan Valley, which runs along the Panj River, and across the river is Afghanistan, is the Wakhan corridor of Afghanistan. And people rave about this. And so I said, okay, I'll loop back and do it, even though I'm feeling kind of tired and burnt out. And I went and I rode the Wakhan Valley for a few days, and I was just aware that I wasn't appreciating the experience that I was in. I missed having conversations in English, because sometimes I'd go a couple of weeks without having a conversation in English of more than 10 seconds. I missed having food that was nourishing and had flavor. And after 4 months on the road, I felt that maybe I would appreciate my experience more if I gave myself time away from it. And so I thought, you know what? I have gotten to the end of the route that I had originally planned. I'd needed to get through the mountains of Central Asia in this quite narrow window during which the passes are open in the high mountains. And so I'd planned up to Dushanbe, which is the capital of Tajikistan, and I got there. I said, you know, if I get there, I'll plan the rest after that. And got there and I thought, you know, I've set out to accomplish what I originally set out to accomplish, and I'm not time pressured in terms of where I can travel based on the weather right now. So why don't I take a break and actually see people that I miss back home?
Wow. And so you did.
And so I did.
Here you are. How is it being back here?
It's amazing, honestly. Like, you know, getting to see my parents, Steve and Elaine, who are really fantastic people, getting to see my sister, Elizabeth, is amazing. Getting to see all my childhood friends who are still in the area is really great. But then there's also stuff that you don't think about that is also incredibly nice. Like, it is such a luxury being invisible, where if I'm out on the street, no one has any idea that I'm not from here. I don't stand out in any way. Even when I talk, I don't stand out in any way. And to not be an object of attention after having been often quite intensely an object of attention for many months is really a huge luxury.
Very interesting. What an interesting perspective. What do you think of your Indians winning 20 games in a row? I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but it's a big deal here.
Yeah, I've actually watched the last two games, and it's pretty cool. It is really impressive. And baseball was the sport that I played when I was a kid.
Oh, good.
So I have a connection to it. You know, I understand that in many ways baseball is not the most dynamic sport. I mean, thank God it's more dynamic than cricket. Australians have no idea what they're doing. But I still have a huge love for it.
Yeah, me too.
And it's pretty neat to see what they're doing. And it's cool that I'm home for this.
Yeah, no kidding. How long will you be home?
I'm here in Northeast Ohio until the 22nd, and then I'm visiting some friends in Boston and New York, and then D.C.
Wait, you're going to be in Boston next weekend?
Yeah.
You know that the Builders Ball is there. Brian and I will be in Boston next weekend.
Oh, seriously?
Yes.
That's fabulous.
Yes, we will be in Boston on the 23rd at the Innovation and Design Center.
That's crazy.
For a day of handmade bikes.
Yeah, small world.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, good for you.
And then I'll be flying out to Europe for about a month, and I'm going to backpack around a bit, do some camping. And then my girlfriend Alice, who is a crazy girl from Northern England, is actually on her own separate bicycle trip. She's been in Indonesia and Thailand and Malaysia and now in Myanmar. And she is going to be meeting me in Kathmandu in the beginning of November. And we're going to go trekking for about a month and a half.
And what do you do with the bikes while you're doing these other crazy things?
Fortunately, the bike is going to stay here in the loving arms of my parents, or more likely in their garage.
Right.
And when it comes time to pick up the trip again, they're retired now, so they deeply need something to keep them entertained.
So let's pack the bike.
Yeah, so right? So I'll probably have my dad hopefully pack up the bike and work out couriering it to me somewhere.
So I have crazy questions that I always ask every guest.
Sure.
And one of them, and I'm going to sort of change the way I ask this one. I usually ask somebody what is his or her favorite food. But what do you think is your favorite food that we wouldn't necessarily think of here in the States that you might eat in Australia, if there is such a thing? And maybe not.
Australia has, you know, it doesn't have a culinary tradition of its own in a lot of ways. One of the things that I really do love about living in Sydney is there have been sort of so many waves of immigration to Australia. I mean, it's a country that has a tremendous percentage of its population being immigrants, of which I am now one. And there is central Sydney, but then as you go out into the western suburbs, there are almost sort of food ghettos where individual suburbs will have a big population of Lebanese people or Vietnamese or Indian. And they are paradises of those particular foods.
Yum, yum.
So I think that probably food-wise, the stuff that I love eating most in Sydney would be Vietnamese food, especially out in the suburb of Cabramatta. Oh, So good. And Lebanese food out in maybe Granville. Just absolutely incredible stuff.
Nice. What kind of music do you like and or listen to? I mean, obviously music is pretty global, but...
It's a lot of different stuff. I actually was reflecting in the car on the way here on what I listened to the most while I was out riding, because I often listen to music while I was on the road. And I found that the albums that I played the most often were Frank Ocean's most recent album, Blonde. I listened to that a ton. I listened to Old Tears for Fears a lot. I listened to a lot of Drake. And,
okay.
I listened to a couple of different albums by the indie band The War on Drugs.
Nice. Nice. Okay, so this is going to sound weird because you're here and evidently you have a place in Australia. Do you have any pets?
No, I don't. No. I've tended to organize my life such as to minimize anything that's not immediately transportable.
Right.
So no pets at this point. At some point, really like to have a dog.
How about an Aussie, a little Australian shepherd? They are so cute.
They are very cute.
Yeah, they are. Well, Matthew, this has just been a wonderful conversation. Welcome home. I know you're not going to stay. It's been nice to see your bike. By the way, we didn't mention the bike has a roll-off hub, which, you know, we're heavily into roll-off. We like that stuff. And it's a very cool bike. If I can, maybe we'll snap a picture of it and put it up on Facebook if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right. Well, I hope you have a safe trip. Enjoy your stay here. Enjoy your stay in the States. And if you get to the Innovation and Design Center next Saturday, we'll see you there.
Yeah, funny world.
Funny world. Thanks for stopping by.
Cool. Thank you so much, Diane.
Bye-bye. That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed my conversations with Eric Weiss from the New England Builders Ball, Dave Dean with SineWave, Len G from the EOD Warrior Foundation, and Matthew Crompton. All of the information about the Builders Ball, SineWave, and the EOD Undefeated Warrior Ride is available on our Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. If you're anywhere near Boston next Saturday and you're in the mood to see a lot of really cool things about cycling, stop by and say hi to Brian and me at the New England Builders Ball. In the meantime, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.